Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Living History. Thank you for tuning in and joining us in this new season, and a special thank you to our subscribers, who we always appreciate. If you subscribe, you get bonus content, you get early access, ad-free listening, all the wonderful things that come with subscriptions. So check out the link in the show notes if you want to subscribe and get extra content. Today's episode, one that I'm really looking forward to. It's a subject close to my heart because it's not just World War II, but it's the Solomon Islands, and Solomon Islands is a destination I've spent a lot of time in. I know the people really well. I know the history really well, and it's a very rich history. And I think this is one of the most intriguing chapters of that history. We're going to be talking about JFK and the disaster that befell him when he was in the Navy, and a very interesting Australian connection to that. And to tell us all about it is the author of a new book, Saving Lieutenant Kennedy. It's Brett Mason. Brett, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's terrific to be on your show. Thank you.
Well, we should start at the outset. This is a really important one. He was Lieutenant Kennedy from an American perspective, but we say Lieutenant. Are we going to refer to him as Lieutenant or Lieutenant? What have you done during the process of writing this book?
I'm at ease, Matt. At ease. It's fine.
We'll see. Whatever comes up, whichever way it goes, we'll accept both at this stage. So it's a fascinating story. People may have heard a little bit about it, but Kennedy was a commander of a PT boat sunk by a Japanese destroyer, and then his very heroic rescue story. Before we get into the story, I'd love to hear a little bit more about you, Brett, and what you do and how you came to write this book.
Oh, Matt, deep past, I was was a lawyer, and then an academic lawyer, and then a politician, and then a diplomat. So it's a checkered history. And I had heard about many years ago about Reg Evans. So I knew of him. And what really sponsored my work on him was really timing. Life's all about timing, they say. And in the past, Patrick Lindsay, I think Michael Veitch, and Michael Adams had done a great podcast touching on Reg Evans. But because Caroline Kennedy, the president's daughter, of course, is the American ambassador to Australia, her appointment, the fact that it was 80 years ago, last August, since the rescue of Lieutenant Kennedy, and also, of course, 60 years last November since President Kennedy's death, all of that came together. And so very quickly, I had to write the book after Wizards of Oz, which is my previous book that, again, touched on the Second World War. So I knew about Reg Evans, and I thought, this is the opportunity, and I did it pretty quickly.
Well, let's talk, before we dig right into the story of JFK, let's talk, Reg Evans was a coast watcher, and this is one of the most intriguing stories of the Pacific War, almost romantic, certainly heroic.
Yes.
Just give us your overview of the coast watchers and what they did and how they contributed to the Pacific War.
Well, they were really intelligence officers, often behind, of course, Japanese lines or enemy lines. And they were, before there were drones and satellites, they were our way of keeping an eye on the enemy. And Reg Evans himself described himself as like being a spider in a web, the eyes and ears of the Pacific. And it was, as you suggest, Matt, it was perilous. In fact, Eric Felt, Lieutenant Commander Eric Felt, said that to recruits to the Coast Watchers, he said, "I can promise you only one thing, the promise of certain peril." And, you know, if you were caught, you would be executed as a spy, and many were, as you know. So it was very, very dangerous, and you really had to rely on, if you're in Papua New Guinea, Papua New Guineans, Solomon Islanders, the Bougainvillians and so forth, you had to rely on the local indigenous population for your to do your work and indeed for your survival. But we shouldn't forget that it was not only very dangerous for Coast Watchers, it was very dangerous for the Solomon Islander scouts that assisted the Australian Coast Watchers. Now, mainly Australian. There was an American in the end who worked with Reg Evans. But if they were caught, just like in partisan Europe, you know, their entire family could be killed, or indeed their village. So it was perilous for the Coast Watcher, but also for the people who helped them and assisted them. And there was never a case in the entire Second World War where Solomon Islanders betrayed the trust of the Coast Watchers. It's extraordinary loyalty and fealty, given that the British hadn't always treated the Solomon Islanders all that well necessarily, but they were certainly very loyal to the Allied cause. There's no question about that.
Well, it's such, you're so right. I mean, there's some famous Solomon Islander scouts and Joseph Uzzah and a whole bunch of scouts that remain very important to the people of the Solomon Islands. And I was very lucky that a decade or so ago, they opened a new memorial in Honiara in the Solomon Islands to the scouts and the Coast Watchers. And we made a donation as part of my tour company because we were sending lots of Australians over there. And it's a magnificent memorial right in the heart of the town. And its purpose is really important because it's to remind modern Solomon Islanders of what their forebears did and the contribution that was played by these brave people. And obviously in a nation that's had its issues with stability and tensions, sure. It's a really important aspect of their history. So I think it's really wonderful that more information is coming about what the Coast Watchers did and more information about the scouts that supported them, because it's really just an integral part of that fabric of modern day Solomon Islands.
That's right. I've tried it in the book, Matt, to bring out the contribution of the scouts, because it does get, as you're suggesting, it can get lost. Originally it was all about the Americans, and then it's about the Aussies. And I'm trying to lift the profile, but it's difficult because, you know, there's not a lot of history that was recorded, but at least people like your good self, understand how absolutely critical they were to our work during the Second World War.
It's also it's fascinating that the story of the Coast Watchers is one of those strange World War II things where everyone kind of knows the word, they kind of know what went on, but no one really knows the full extent of the story. And I just imagine what that must have been like. Imagine being camping out on a little isolated island behind Japanese lines, watching Japanese ships go past, watching patrol planes fly over, and then making the incredibly risky move to then report that back to Guadalcanal or another base on a radio, and knowing that the Japanese were scanning and trying to pinpoint, yes, trying to triangulate where you were. Yeah. I mean, it must have been. I don't know how those blokes dealt with stress, but they obviously did it pretty well.
They must have. And you're right, how critical they were originally when just after the Battle of Guadalcanal, and the American Marines took the airport at Lunga, the Australian Coast Watchers in Bougainville, Paul Mason, no relation of mine, but, you know, relay sent word that 24 bombers, Japanese bombers, were coming south from Rabaul to the Solomon Islands, and that gave the Americans just over 2 hours advance notice of their arrival. And that made all the difference, Matt, made all the difference. They could prepare, they got ready, and, of course, they got one hell of a welcome when they arrived. And there's no question without that preparation, the landing would have been imperiled on the Solomon Islands. And that's why, famously, Admiral Halsey said that the Coast Watchers saved Guadalcanal and Guadalcanal saved the Pacific.
It's one of those things we can't emphasize enough, the importance of aircraft being in the air to meet an attack. If those American fighters on the airfield were still on the ground when the Japanese Betty bombers appeared overhead, firstly, they may have been destroyed, and secondly, they would not have had time to climb and engage the bombers before the attack had taken place. Mm. So the significance of getting a couple of hours of warning so you could get your aircraft in the air, and then as soon as the bombers appeared, the aircraft were ready to meet them. I mean, there's parallels with the Battle of Britain with early warning radar and early radar sets and things like that, but that we cannot overemphasize the significance of getting those aircraft in the air. And that's what the Coast Watchers were so vital for, not just in Guadalcanal campaign, but throughout the Pacific. It's just an extraordinary story. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Reg Evans. Firstly, great Australian name, Reginald Evans. I mean, you can't do better than that.
No, terrific name.
I mean, he was born to be a Coast Watcher or a hero of World War II with a name like that, wasn't he? But tell us a little bit about Reg Evans. I mean, is the book a story of Reg Evans, or is the book a story of JFK?
It's a story of both. It's a story of how an Australian and his scouts rescued an American, and how America discovered Australia, and how Australia discovered America, and how that has mattered ever since. That's really okay. The book, isn't it? That's great. Really the book.
That's a good summation. Tell us about Reg. What's his story? How did he come to be a Coast Watcher?
Oh, born in 1905 and in a city, Sydney. So a dozen years before Jack Kennedy. He was an intelligent bloke, always loved the sea. So when he finished school, wanted to join the Royal Australian Navy, which was just setting up a base then, I think originally in Victoria, then later on at Jarvis Bay. He didn't make it. He didn't get in. But his wanderlust and his intelligence, he was able to get a job in what was then called the New Hebrides, which is now called Vanuatu. And so he loved the South Pacific. He was very good with people. And, of course, this held him in very good stead for later on, Matt, when he was in the Solomon Islands. When that went in during the Depression, he had to come back to Sydney because the copra and cocoa markets fell apart. And then though he persisted, training as a bookkeeper, and then went back to Solomon Islands and remained there until the beginning of the Second World War, when he turned back up in went back to Sydney and joined the Royal Australian Artillery and served, of course, then in North Africa. But he was a guy who loved the sea, loved the South Pacific, was very good with people. And he was a little bloke, about 5'4". I'm not sure what that is in centimetres, but 164 centimetres or something.
Short is the answer.
Yeah, diminutive, I think.
That's a technical term, yeah.
Yeah. A guy with reddish any hair, freckled, angular face, but a very broad smile with bright blue eyes. And people liked Reg Evans. He was very good with people. And I think that, of course, is why he was such a good Coast Watcher. And then later on, when he came back, having served in North Africa, he just joined as a private, but was promoted to warrant officer in North Africa. So he was, he had something about him. There's no question about that. And then he again applied for the Royal Australian Navy, and he was successful because they realised we need people like Reg Evans with his background in the Pacific as a Coast Watcher. And, of course, then in late 1942, he went off to Solomon Islands.
And where was he stationed throughout his time in the Solomons?
Originally at Lunga Point, where the Aussies, the Coast Watchers, and as I say, they're nearly all Australian, set up their base right next to the Americans, the Marines and the Army Air Force, the Air Force base at Lunga Point. And then he went from there, after settling in and learning the ropes, he went to an island called Kolombangara Island. And from there, and it was a very hazardous trip getting there, frankly. He had to go past, as you mentioned before, behind Japanese lines, travelling by night, and he could hear the Japanese, just a few hundred metres away. It was very perilous, but he got to Kolombangara, where the locals assisted him in establishing a base on the mountain, overlooking Blackett Strait and overlooking the Japanese supply lines. So he had a great spot. But perilous it was, but it was from there, of course, from that great vantage point, he could keep a lookout at what was going on, particularly with Japanese destroyers and transporting goods to and resupplying Japanese soldiers.
We should do a little bit of geography here so people understand. So Guadalcanal is the main island in the Solomon Islands. People get confused and think it's a waterway. Guadalcanal is the biggest island in the Solomon's chain where the capital Honiara is now. And there's a string of islands that stretch all the way sort of northwest up towards Bougainville and beyond. And at the end of that point is Rabaul, the Japanese strong point in New Britain. And so that was where the Japanese were based. That's where their ships and aircraft were, most of their troops were. And because the two rows of islands run roughly parallel together, the waterway in between them where the Japanese used to come down to resupply their forces further south was known as the Slot. And it was really important that we knew what was going on, both on the sea and in the skies above the Slot. And so the island, I always get the name wrong, Columbangara?
Is it? Columbangara, yes.
Columbangara, yes. Yep. I've been there as well. It's a dramatic island. It's a huge volcano sticking up out of the sea. It's one of the big landmarks all the way around. And so it was an essential point because from there they could see aircraft coming over. They could see Japanese ships making their way from Rabaul southeast down to Guadalcanal. So an essential spot. And then obviously as the fighting moved onwards through the Solomon campaign and the Americans captured more islands, the front line moved sort of northwestwards back through the Solomons. But all of those islands were really hotly contested by the Japanese. And it's probably a really overlooked chapter of the Pacific story is that fighting into 1943 as they pushed the Japanese back up through the Solomon Islands. We talk about the fighting, later on in 1943 and, of course, into 1944. But that fighting was some pretty horrific stuff. I've spoken to veterans who fought all the way up to including Bougainville in 43 and some pretty hairy actions.
Yes, it was very hairy is a good word. I had the chance to speak to one veteran, the last Coast Watcher, Jim Burrows, who's 100 now, he's 100. And it's funny, though, he was 18 when he joined up, Matt, and he thought it was very exciting. And I said, well, weren't you scared? He said, not when you're 18, you're not scared. Brett, you just you just jump in. So it's very interesting, isn't it? From the sound of it. And the descriptions from veterans, you think how horrendous. But I suppose when you're a teenager, it's one hell of an adventure. But just shocking conditions they had to endure, appalling conditions.
Yeah, in the jungle. Well, tell us about that. Tell us about how Reg was set up on Columbangara, and then we'll talk about the great event that he witnessed from there.
Well, he was lucky, Matt. He had the assistance of the locals, and so they took him, and it took about eight men to carry all his gear, you know, everything from the generators for the radio, his telescope, his rifle and all his gear to the top of the mountain. And they took him to the best spot because they knew where the best spot was. And he loved it. Reg Evans wrote later on that he loved being a coast watcher, loved being involved. And scared, yes, but in a sense, they just got used to that. And after a while, he said it became more and more, routine. And while he could see the Japanese, not far away at all, and he said, they could have found him very easily just by combing up the hill, but they didn't. And he was protected very much by the locals. So he relied, he said, without the assistance of locals, he wouldn't have lasted 10 minutes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And let's now talk about JFK. I mean, can you give us a bit of a backstory about JFK's war service? He was a young man, obviously no dreams of president at this stage. Tell us about JFK and his World War II experience.
Well, he was born 1917 to a thrusting Irish-American family, Matt, and he was initially he wanted to see active service, but his parents weren't so keen on that. And he did have health issues, gastrointestinal issues. And so originally he was an intelligence officer when war broke out in 1941, of course, with Pearl Harbor. So he was, by then, he joined the Navy, United States Navy. But he didn't want to be an intelligence officer. He wanted to see active service, you know, combat service. And he really had to fight hard to get to see that active service. He didn't have to. He could have had a much more comfortable life and a respectable life as an intelligence officer in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. But no, he wanted that, and he pressed his parents' contacts to get it. Finally, he was allowed to see active service, and he arrived in the Solomons in 1943, about April of 1943, and he wrote to his then girlfriend that, honey, I wanted to see active service and now I'm getting it. Just as he arrived, the Japanese bombed ships just around him where he was as they were coming into port. So,
you know, he was in Tulagi originally, wasn't he? The island just off Guadalcanal. It's a spot I've been to, and it's the PT boat base there is quite extraordinary. So tell us about that. Tell us about the PT boats and what he was commissioned to do there.
Well, it was very romantic. PT boats had saved General MacArthur, and you carried him off from Corregidor to finally, of course, MacArthur landing back in Australia. They'd saved MacArthur and his entourage. Lieutenant John Buckley was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honour in PT boats. These mahogany hull boats, they were very fast, they were nimble, but, the torpedoes didn't work, Matt. You know, they really weren't very effective as machines of war. But they were very romantic if you're a young man, because you had a crew of about a dozen, your own boss. And so there were thousands of applicants to become a new Lieutenant John Buckley and, save General MacArthur and do other great daring do in the Second World War. He got there. In fact, he was so good, Lieutenant Kennedy, that he became an instructor in Rhode Island for a while on PT boats. He's very good at it. But when he arrived in Solomons, was given PT-109, of course, the famous PT-109, and spent several weeks, indeed a couple of months, learning the trade before being sent out with a group of, 15, one night to interrupt what they used to call the Tokyo Express, Matt, which you've already alluded to, which was Japanese destroys and transports ships coming south to resupply Japanese soldiers.
Before we get on to the specifics of what happened to JFK, I want to talk a little bit about the PT boat and what they were trying to do and actually how they went, because it wasn't effective as a weapon. It was I was going to say it's a great idea. I'm not sure it was a great idea, but basically these are relatively small boats for a Navy, very fast, as you say, very powerfully equipped with their engines. And the concept was that they would be able to race up towards a Japanese fleet, dodging machine gun fire, and then fire torpedoes at the Japanese ships at relatively close range, and then zip off again before the Japanese could react. Didn't really work like that in practice, though, did it?
No, it didn't. In fact, Matt, one of the authors I read put it very bluntly. He said the problem was the torpedoes didn't work. And he said there's virtually no recorded instance where a torpedo hit a destroyer or a transport ship and sunk it from a PT boat ever. They had very little armor. If they were hit by a bullet, that could stop a PT boat. They had petroleum, and it was aviation fuel, and it was highly flammable. And of course, that becomes important in a few minutes' time when we're discussing what happened to PT-109. But so they were fast, but they had no armor, and their armaments didn't work properly. You know, so they really were very, very vulnerable, in particular at nighttime to planes overhead that could see their, you know, the water coming behind PT boats. And what would happen is that Japanese pilots would see the PT boats and, of course, try to take them out in the water as well. So I think it's fair to say they were not an effective instrument of war, though they were, after PT-109, he was given a command of another PT boat, and they had much better armour and they were much better armaments. So it did get better, but I don't think they were ever, you know, they were romantic, great for raising war bonds, but not too effective on the battlefield.
Well, I think Kennedy was well suited as a, you know, he was young and good looking and athletic. He was well suited to this sort of dashing hero of the PT boat. Well, let's talk about it. Let's talk about what happened later in 1943. So he's commanding PT-109. He's got his crew. What happened to JFK? What was the story of PT-109?
Well, it's August the 1st, 1943. They went out. Lieutenant Kennedy, actually, he had a crew of 12 that night. Usually it was 12, but he had an extra crew. So 13, that was everyone. There were 15 PT boats went out that night, and they were there to intercept the Tokyo Express, you know, resupplying Japanese soldiers on the islands in the Solomons. What happened was they didn't see anyone. So the hours went by, and by about 2 in the morning, the four leaders of the 15 boats, and they were the only ones that actually had radar, had gone back to base. Torpedoes had been fired but had not hit anything. And left in Blackett Strait were three T-boats. And about 2:30 in the morning, while I was thinking of all going back to Rendova, the US base, it was really misty. Dark and misty, and you know, visibility was very, very poor. Out of the mist, out of the fog, came a Japanese destroyer, and they saw Kennedy's boat, PT-109, and they rammed it. The Amagari rammed Kennedy's boat. They hit it, split it in two, and, of course, it went up. The petroleum ignited, and of the 13 crew, two were killed instantly, and the other 11 ended up in the water, you know, holding on for dear life. But fortunately, some of the craft did float, and they were able to hold on. Some of the men were badly burned. Some of them couldn't swim. Man, I didn't know that, but some of them couldn't even swim properly, but nonetheless, they held on. And as this was happening, Reg Evans and Kolomangara Island could see the fire on the water and thought, what is that? What's going on? He looked through his French telescope, thought he could see Americans, but, you know, he wasn't sure. The fire was so intense that it scarred the paint of the Japanese destroyer, and then the Japanese, for good measure, fired a few machine gun bursts back into the burning crew of PT-109. So they were lucky they weren't all killed. But 11 ended up in the water, and they were there for about 11 or 12 hours in the water before Kennedy decided, we have to get out of here. And then they spotted a little island several kilometres away called Plum Pudding Island, now called Kennedy Island, and they swam. It took them about four and a half hours to get there, and Kennedy, with his, you know, by his teeth, grabbed the life vest of one of his crewmen and breaststroke all the way to the island, and the others were carried along on the sort of the flotation, any flotation remnants left from the boat. And they all made it to the island by late that afternoon. So it was an extraordinary survival story.
Well, and let's talk for a minute about what a perilous situation they were in, Brett, because it's bad enough being in a boat behind Japanese lines near Japanese occupied islands, but being in the water and now stranded on an island. I mean, even had they been discovered, okay, let's talk about a whole host of things.
Yeah.
Exposure, lack of food and water, you know, the perils of being in the Pacific. We all know the stories of shipwrecks in the Pacific. I mean, the perils of being in the Pacific, but then the notion that if the Japanese found them, they would have had no hope of survival. The Japanese didn't take prisoners. The Japanese captured plenty of people, but it was rare for them to be taken prisoner. So most people were executed fairly swiftly after being captured. So
that's right.
It could not have been a more dangerous situation that they
stage
of the war.
Absolutely, mate. You're quite right. So when they're floating down in a Blackett Strait, to their right, you've got about 10,000 Japanese troops on Kolombangara, the station just below Reg Evans' lookout, and then the Gizo anchorage to their left, you have several hundred Japanese soldiers at the Gizo anchorage, plus of course patrol, you know, air patrols and naval patrols, because they're behind Japanese lines. And Perilous is right. If they'd been caught, yeah, they would not have lasted very long in Japanese hands. And secondly, of course, they're worried about the wildlife as well. You know, the sharks and the crocodiles and barracuda, apparently, that Kennedy was told would come up and bite a man's testicles off. So he was worried about, Kennedy was very worried about.
With good reason.
Yeah,
about you can't that. Blame him for that.
No. So they're all worried, you know, for all sorts of reasons. So perilous is the right word.
So they got to Plum Pudding Island.
Yeah, they did. And which is, Matt, you've seen it, but it's a very small, it's about the size of a football field or something. And they hid under the casuarina bushes there. But there weren't really any accessible coconuts and no water. And, of course, then they were exhausted. Arrived there 15 hours
floating. Some of them were suffering burns as well, weren't they? From the
suffering burns, some had swallowed petrol fumes, and they weren't in good order at all. But they were alive, and they were young, and they're young and pretty fit. Kennedy went out that night again, trying to flag down a PT boat, unsuccessfully. Enormous energy, Jack Kennedy, enormous energy, and what happened is a day later they went further south to Olesana Island, which is larger and had, of course, coconuts. But it didn't look good when Reg Evans saw the fire on the water. And, of course, he learnt the next day that it was PT-109. So bad was it that they even had a memorial service for Jack Kennedy back at Rendova, because everyone thought that they were all dead, including the other PT boats that had seen the explosion. It's pretty bad.
So they're now on another island. They're gathered there, and then Kennedy makes his extraordinary decision that they either had to do something or they're all going to die on that island. So tell us what he did next.
Well, he came further down that group of islands because he wanted to flag down American PT boats. And on one occasion, he went to the most southern island and Cross Island or Gross Island, and with Ensign Barney Ross. They turned up on the island and they're looking around and they found actually some crate of Japanese sweets and some fresh water and even a little canoe hidden on the island. And as they were coming around the corner, this is after about, they hadn't seen anyone for 2.5 days, they came across two Solomon Islanders, Matt, out in the water looking over a Japanese wreck. And Kennedy and Barney Ross waved to get the attention of the Solomon Islanders. But the Islanders thought, maybe they're Japanese or, we don't know who they are. They may be enemy. And the Solomon Islanders fled. And, of course, the Solomon Islanders were went from there to Kamana and Gaza, from there to Olesana Island and to get some coconuts, and bumped into Kennedy's crew. So when later that night, when Kennedy and Barney Ross got back, guess who they found around the island, around the campfire on the island? The two Solomon Islanders they'd seen earlier that day. And, of course, that closed the circle and was the beginning of the rescue operation.
When you say here as well that JFK went from one island to another, what you mean is he swam from one island to another. He was a very strong swimmer.
He was
a champion swimmer at school, and he was swimming between these islands, and he later described that a number of times he thought he wasn't going to make it. And these aren't close, these islands. They're many kilometres apart. And so he was swimming from island to island. It's absolutely extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? And so dangerous in you know, the wildlife and the Japanese and the rest of it. But he really, whatever people say about, you know, Kennedy was criticised about, you know, why was he rammed by a Japanese boat, his Japanese destroyer. You know, PT boats were very, very nimble, very fast. What was he doing idling on one engine, all this sort of stuff. And he's criticised for that. But there is no question that from the time the Japanese destroyer hit the PT boat, that he was a very brave individual. There's no question about that. Brave and energetic, and in the end, very, very lucky.
It was certainly fortunate that he ran into the two Solomon Islanders. And actually, I was fortunate enough myself to meet one of them. Many years ago, Irone Kamana, I met when I was in the Solomon Islands, which was quite extraordinary. He was wearing a T-shirt that said, "I saved JFK." So obviously a hero to the Solomon Islands. But tell us about that rescue. So they're on this island. They're in a terrible way. They're starving. They've got no, you know, they've run out of water just about. Some of them are injured and burnt. Kennedy's exhausted from all his swims. How did they get word back to the Americans that they were there?
Yeah, all they had at the time was some coconuts to eat, Matt. And what happened when they got back and they were smoking cigarettes around the campfire? They thought, how, you know, we need to get word back. And so next morning, it was Irone Kamana had the idea of grabbing a coconut, a green coconut, and sending a message, okay, with a coconut. And so Kennedy got the coconut, scrawled a message inside, carved a message inside, and asked the two Solomon Islander scouts to take that message back to Rendova, you know, the American base. And basically it said, you know, this is, you know, 11 crew alive, this is where we are, and gave the location, and also, of course, Kennedy. So, you know, they knew he was still alive from PT-109. The scouts, again, extraordinary bravery, paddled off from Olisana Island towards Rendova, but they stopped, caught up with other scouts, who then informed Reg Evans about what was going on. They continued on their way to Rendova. But the scouts informed Reg Evans, and Reg Evans said, "Right, we will send some scouts to pick up Kennedy and plan the rescue." And that's what happened. So we have a coconut going back to the American base at Rendova, and at the same time we have Reg Evans being informed, who had just moved to a very, very small island called Gomu, a speck of an island where he was based, which gave him even a better view of Japanese operations. And what happened was that the next morning, when he found out, he sent Benjamin Kevu, who appears later in the story, who spoke very good English, and another six or seven scouts back to Olisana Island, back to pick up Kennedy and his crew. And they did that. Later that day, they arrived, had a big lunch, and they picked Kennedy up from the island, Olisana, and took him back to Gomu, where Reg Evans was stationed. And even that trip was so hazardous, Matt, because the scouts put him under the palm leaves to protect him from the Japanese who are above, you know, searching, of course. And at one stage they were buzzed by Japanese aircraft, but they couldn't see Kennedy because he was under the palm fronds. And Benjamin Kevu just waved at the Japanese pilots. And as they approached Gomu, they were late for a start. They were very late. Evans was increasingly worried and agitated that something had gone wrong. And finally, late in the afternoon, they could see his boat, the boat with Kevu and Kennedy on it, coming towards them. They couldn't see Kennedy because he was hidden. And just as they were coming towards the beach, out jumps this exhausted, sunburned, disheveled, unshaven young American. And he jumps onto the beach, very skinny and bedraggled, you know, walks up the beach and says, hi, you know, am I glad to see you? And Reg Evans grabs him by the hand and said, mate, I'm bloody glad to see you too. And that, of course, was the beginning of the planning the rescue from there.
It's such an extraordinary story, Brett, and it was one that stayed with Kennedy for the rest of his life, wasn't it?
Of course.
It was a story that he, I mean, as president, he had the coconut on his desk in the White House.
He did.
And so it was instrumental in making him the man who became president, because it was a hell of a story. He was a war hero. He was decorated for his efforts. It was a really important aspect of Kennedy's young life, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Somewhere, someone describes the coconut and other talismans on the way to power that are all on his desk. And that's true. It was a nautical flavour in the Oval Office in the Kennedy administration. And Matt, you did right. President Eisenhower, of course, was commander in chief or supreme commander. But Kennedy fought it. Fought the war. And those following, Addie Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and so on, and right up to George Bush Senior, they'd all fought in the Second World War. Ronald Reagan as well, in different capacities, sure. But they were all returned servicemen. And Kennedy, the difference was, Kennedy was a genuine hero. He won the Marine and Navy Medal, and I think the Purple Heart for being injured, of course, as well on the boat. But that people who worked for Kennedy, some of them believe he never would have become president if he hadn't been a war hero, because they used that, the story originally published by John Hersey about the rescue. It was published in New Yorker, got great publicity for a young Jack Kennedy. It was then reprinted in Reader's Digest and sent over the years from 1946 when he ran for Congress right through to 1960, at 14 years. Millions of people read about the heroism of JFK. As a former politician, I can say these things are great because they distinguish you, Matt, as someone special or different.
And tell us more about Reg. What happened to him after the rescue of Kennedy, the rest of his war? Tell us about Reg.
Well, Kennedy was the only American serviceman that he rescued, per se. So he remembered who he was, even though Kennedy had misremembered Evans and thought he was a New Zealander, and said to John Hersey in the original article, he described him as Lieutenant Wincote of the New Zealand Army. And only as Kennedy became more and more famous, people started to ask, who is this Lieutenant Wincote? And in the end, in 1960, Reg Evans outed himself as the rescuer of JFK, and proved it by showing the logbooks. But just after what happened, after he'd rescued Kennedy, he left. He stopped being a coast watcher because he was exhausted by the fact that American bombers kept strafing the islands, and he said he couldn't call on the support and the loyalty of Solomon Islands anymore because they kept on getting bombed by poorly trained American bombers and fighter crews. So he was a little bit shattered. Won a Distinguished Service Cross from George VI, and then worked in the British Colonial Service for many years in Ghana on the west coast of Africa. But he had a very good career, but then only became famous because Kennedy became famous. Otherwise, it never would have happened. He never would have outed himself.
This is a pretty instrumental moment in US-Australian affairs. I mean, it's a tangible moment. It's a specific moment of Australians and Americans coming together in dire circumstances. But this was a time of change for Australia in general, wasn't it, in our relationship with the US and the movement away from the UK and towards the US as our big brother in the region. Just tell us a little bit about your perspective in writing the book. Is this a metaphor for what became later between the relationship between Australia and the US?
Yes, it is. And you put it very, very well. I'd assume that Australia and America had a more significant relationship than they did, in fact, before the Second World War. It wasn't significant. And let me not go into it now, but suffice to say it wasn't significant. Americans had fought with Lieutenant General Monash at Hamel briefly. There'd been some trade, but not much. We watched American movies in the 20s and 30s, but really there was very little between the two countries. It was World War II, security concerns, and the Japanese that threw us together. It wasn't a marriage. It was a shotgun wedding, I tell you. We were thrown together to fight the Japanese to defend our country. Just outside here, I live on the Brisbane River. It was full of US destroyers and submarines just outside my window here. It was a time when Australia, indeed here in Brisbane, absolutely desperate for the assistance of the United States. And we came together. It changed Australia, as you say, from depending upon the empire and the United Kingdom. We relied much more on the United States. But also Australia was very, very British, very white and very British. We were not a multicultural nation before the Second World War. We saw ourselves. John Curtin would say that. John Curtin, Labor Prime Minister, we are British. But after the war, we'd seen the success of America. This Kennedy exemplified it, this maybe disheveled but confident, energetic, go-getting, a superpower on the make. And Kennedy exemplified that. We learned from them. And, of course, after the war, mass immigration and, of course, the Cold War as well cemented our relationship with the United States.
Did Reg ever meet JFK again after rescuing him on that island?
Yes, he did. So after he was finally identified, indeed, when Kennedy first met Robert Menzies, our Prime Minister, in February of 1961, not long after he was inaugurated, Kennedy said to Menzies, Australia is partly responsible for my administration. And he said, because Reg Evans. And Evans was invited to the White House and arrived on May the 1st, 1961. They spent half an hour together, 20 minutes in private. And Reg Evans paid the greatest compliment ever, Matt. He said, we got on like two old cobbers, Kennedy and I. So that's the greatest Australian compliment. And there is some footage, actually, on YouTube of it. It's silent. But a wonderful moment for Australia and, indeed, for our relationship with the United States. I mean, you couldn't get a better, icebreaker between Menzies and Kennedy than, I'm here. I'm still alive because of your country. We did very well with President Kennedy.
Well, presidents and politicians in general, larger than life. I mean, someone like Kennedy is such an iconic figure. But I love that story because at the end of the day, he was also an ex-serviceman. He was a veteran of the war. He'd been through combat, and as had Reg. And it's what I've always found whenever I've spoken to veterans from any era, from any war of any age, there's a bond, a comradeship, brothers in arms. That is true that they do have an understanding, and I've seen it so many times. It's a wonderful thing to see when you get two veterans together just talking about their experiences. And I know that's what would have been going on in that 20 minutes in private. It wouldn't have been, oh, Mr. President, how's foreign policy looking? It would have been, tell us about your war, Reg, and, remember the days on New Georgia. Wasn't that a shitstorm? And it would have been that sort of conversation because I think being in combat is the ultimate icebreaker and brings down a lot of barriers. So I really love that story.
Yeah. And, of course, a year later, Benjamin Kevu, who I mentioned before, met President Kennedy. That's in September of 1962 when the America's Cup was being run and Australia for the first time competed for it. And Kevu then met President Kennedy in the White House, and there was this great, a lot of publicity around Evans, Benjamin Kevu, President Kennedy, the America's Cup. And it was quite a – it was a big moment for Australia early on.
Well, Brett, it's an extraordinary story. I mean, it's a story that I'm surprised hasn't received more publicity than it has up until this point, because it's such an incredible story. The book is excellent. It's a fantastic read. And I would encourage everyone to go out and get a copy of it. It's called Saving Lieutenant Kennedy, all about the story of Reg Evans. And just very briefly, Brett, what are you working on now? What are we going to see next from Brett Mason?
Oh, I'm not sure, Matt. I think it just I had to complete that book so quickly, it just about killed me. So
I know the feeling. I've just finished my latest book as well, so it's a challenge.
So let me just take a cut. But I think I will give something else a go, but I don't think I quite have your fortitude, Matt. But leave it with me. I'll think of something, I think.
Well, Brett, thank you very much. As I said, the book is called Saving Lieutenant Kennedy. It's out now. You can get it in all good bookshops, written by Brett Mason. And Brett, thank you so much for joining us on Living History.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.